All right, we'll wrap up this particular lesson that we've been on for the last 3 weeks here tonight. So I'll briefly recap the 6 points from our handout. Number one, a budget doesn't work without planning. Number two, we talked about the main categories of a healthy budget. Number three, we said a terrible example of how to run a budget is the United States government. Number four, debt is a severe hindrance to a healthy budget. And number five, the Bible says that co-signing is unwise. And we left off last week on number six, where we said housing is an integral part of your budget. So we talked about some principles there last week about housing and how to try and do it wisely. And just left off a couple things I didn't really have time for, a couple of stories that kind of sort of relate to housing or buying property, but more from a church perspective. A lot of churches have gotten themselves in trouble by building too big of a building or too much property, and then the church had hard times, the attendance wasn't as good, the giving wasn't as good, and then you've got to figure out, can we even keep the property? Is there a way to sell it? Is there a way to downsize? And as we said, the basic biblical teaching is that anytime you're in debt or borrowing, you're put in more of a servant category, where the person who loans the money is like the master and the person who's borrowing the money is servant to the one who has lent it. So one thing that really does help in those situations, even though there's always some risk, is the idea of a down payment or some equity at least gives you some flexibility so that, say, from a church perspective, you buy the property, you build the building. If you've at least put a down payment there, well, then you might be able, if you have hard times, to pull some of the money back out till you figure out how you're going to move or what you're going to do. One church in Texas I heard of that bought a church, that bought a property and built on it. And for them, it worked out extremely well because they bought and built at the right time. The church continued to be strong, have good attendance, and they bought a lot of acreage around the church. And what happened is that the property values continued to skyrocket after they bought it and used, you know, borrowing or bond notes, however they did it, that they were able to slowly fix up the little lots that they owned and subdivide and then sell them off. And they were selling off little chunks of their property for a huge profit and were pretty much paying off all their debt as the years went by because the property was going up in value so rapidly. So as we said, borrowing money or debt is not a sin. It's just something that a lot of the times is unwise. A lot of the times in our personal finances, it's not very wise. And it always comes with a certain amount of risk. I think they said for Donald Trump, the claim was he took like a $1 million loan from his father. And then over the next decades, he turned it into a net worth of around $1 billion. So there are some people who have used that type of strategy that's like you're playing Monopoly and you're very aggressive and they do well. But there's also a lot of people who tried to use debt to fund their ventures and their business ventures that it didn't work out. And so anytime you're borrowing money and there's debt in whatever context, it just raises the risk that you might run into hard times and have a hard time dealing with the loan. There was another church in the South that, again, nobody knows the name of the church, and I doubt anybody would ever listen to this that would, so I don't give names. But they had consolidated two small congregations. They were kind of like us in a certain way where they started out very small at the beginning. The church did well. They were going good, had people in the church that were giving a lot. I don't think they got bigger than around 150, 160 people, and they wanted to build a new building. So they said, we're going to build a $1 million building, and we want to do a fundraising campaign where we try to get churches from all across the nation to build a building for us. And I think they even got a grant where someone gave them some land and they said, let's try to do this building debt-free. And then it kind of became a little bit controversial because other pastors were saying, if every church in America of 100, 150 people tried to get other churches nationwide to give their money to build them a $1 million building, that would kind of eat up the finances of a lot of churches. So some people were saying you probably should just handle on your own whatever kind of building or rent situation you're able to handle. Anyways, with that being said, they were waiting and saying, we don't want any debt at all. We're going to pay cash for all of it. And while they were saving up their money and getting people to give, and I don't know what they had, 500, 600,000, whatever, wasn't enough to pay cash, they finally decided this is taking a long time and prices are going up. So let's go ahead and take what we have saved and go ahead and build the building. And by then, all of the quotes were coming back 1.7 or 1.8 million because they had waited a long time and we went through the supply chain shortage and everything was a lot more expensive for them to go build than it would have been if they had taken a healthy down payment and a payment they thought they could have handled and just gone ahead and built the building. So anyway, there's different situations where wisdom might need to be sought, where you could do something and go forward, even if you're borrowing money for a building or for a house. And if you just waited forever, there wouldn't really be a reason to continue to wait. But if you start off with a good amount of a down payment and a little bit of equity, that will give you some flexibility there. So before we talk about number seven, which is where we'll spend most of our time tonight, I'll give one other note. I think I just forgot to say that we mentioned that the Dave Ramsey class, when they're talking about paying off debt, they recommend doing the snowball method. And the snowball method is you take the lowest debt that you have and you pay that one off first. And then you go to the second smallest debt you have and pay that one off. And other people say, well, on paper, it makes sense to pay off the highest interest rate first because you'll actually save some money. So what the Ramsey plan says is that the science and the studies claim that the snowball method works better because of the human behavioral models where when you pay off a $700 debt, your brain sees you're able to do it and it feels good. Then you go on to the $1,300 debt, then higher and higher, whereas you may say, well, my $60,000 debt has the highest interest rate, so I'll pay that one off first, and then I'll go to the lower ones. The basic argument is that all of the studies show that we're able to get more excited and gain momentum when we pay the smaller debts off first, and whatever money you would have saved by paying the highest interest rate off first can actually end up being very small. So one thing he says is that it's not a math problem because if it was a math problem, we wouldn't get into so much debt in the first place. It's a behavioral thing. So when you start with the smallest debt you owe, attack it, make a lot of progress, and eliminate it, it's very encouraging. And a lot of times you get your momentum up and then you keep going higher and you save the biggest debt you have for last. And then you go after that. So that's a little bit off topic, but I think I forgot to say that from earlier. So let's move on to number seven in our handout tonight, which is married people should do finances together. Married people should do finances together. All right, so just two verses before we talk about a lot of practical things. Matthew 19:5. Jesus said, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh." And then another one that I really enjoy from 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse number 7. "Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them," speaking about your wife, "according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." So Jesus said, when you're married, you're no longer two, you become one in the eyes of God. Then Peter said to the husbands, you should be kind to your wife, dwell with them according to knowledge, give honor unto them. And he says, your prayers will be hindered if you don't treat your wife the right way in the marriage relationship. But he uses the beautiful phrase there, as being heirs together of the grace of life. So when you're married, being heirs, meaning you inherit the grace of life and the goodness that God gives you, I think what we can extrapolate from that verse is that when you're married, everything you do and experience, you do together. So your calling may be in one area and hers may be in another. But as God's called me to try and pastor the church, if the church does well, that's a blessing that's not just for me, that's for me and Melissa because we're married. If she has good things happen to her at work, even though I don't technically have anything to do with the place she works, that's a blessing to me as well, and I should rejoice when she rejoices. So it's a basic marriage principle that whatever good things or bad things or burdens happen to a married couple, they experience it together, and this can apply to finances. So people who are married shouldn't have the attitude of, oh, well, you may need money for groceries, but that's too bad. I made the money this week. I guess you'll have to figure that out. Oh, well, you have debt to pay off, but you're the one that racked up the debt. That's a you problem, not mine. You have your bank account over here. I'll have mine over here, and we'll see who does the best. Rather, the proper way, and I believe the biblical way, the wise way for people to approach finances who are married is that they do it together as a team. They say there are four categories that if you are in agreement on them, when you get married, your chances for staying married and having a successful marriage are much higher. Okay, so four categories that if you agree with your spouse on, your odds for having a successful marriage are very high. The first one is kids. Are you going to have kids? How are you going to raise those kids, etc.? The second one is actually in-laws. Because if you don't have agreement between spouses about what your relationship will be like with the in-laws and what boundaries there may need to be, etc., that causes a lot of stress in a marriage. The third one is religion. And that's obviously top of the list for Christians when we are a single Christian and looking to get married, is we should consider marrying another Christian and only consider that. Again, if we're a single Christian, we should only consider marrying other Christians so that we can be equally yoked. So I've known personal examples, but maybe some of you have known people where a daughter is raised in a certain church and faith tradition, but then she falls for another guy that comes from a totally different one. And it's easy to get caught up in the emotions and just rush into a marriage. And then there's all kinds of issues like, how are we going to raise our kids? And what are we going to tell them is true? And where are we going to take them to church? So it's very important for married couples to be on the same page about faith beliefs. And the fourth one is money. A lot of the stress that occurs in marriage is money. A lot of divorces that happen in the court proceedings, they cite finances and the stresses and disagreements about money. And it's not as simple as make a lot of money and you won't have any marriage problems. That's not what we're saying. But you do have to be in agreement about how you're going to handle finances and seek to do it together. I've actually heard people tell stories where they'll say, well, I can't get married. Well, why can't you get married to your girlfriend or your boyfriend? Well, because I draw or she draws government benefits that they will give to a single person in my tax bracket and income. But if we get married and combine our finances, the government will see that we make this much money and then they will lose their benefits. Now, first of all, as a Christian, if we were ever in that situation, the only thing we should care about is what is right. And God says that marriage is his plan for human sexuality and that outside of a one woman, one man marriage, that when that occurs, God calls it fornication. So even if you were to lose government benefits by doing the right thing and approaching it God's way, you should lose the government benefits. And I promise you, God will take better care of you in the long run than the government will. But it is very sad that sometimes the government laws and tax structures are not set up to benefit marriage or to incentivize marriage, and that's very sad. It's wrong, it's immoral, and it's also very bad for the society on the long trajectory when the government doesn't favor marriage or doesn't orchestrate things in a way that at the very least you're not coming out farther behind in the tax bracket or whatever it is when you're married than if you're single. I heard someone say recently that when you look at all the data and all the statistics, a lot of people will like to talk about white privilege. And they said the actual truth is there's a very real statistical thing called two-parent privilege. In other words, if you have two parents that stay married and raise you together all the way through, you are statistically much more likely to avoid poverty and to do very well. So doing marriage God's way is a blessing to us and to society as a whole. And they say there is a 92 to 97% likelihood that you will avoid being in poverty if you do a couple of basic simple things. Again, the reason I'm talking about poverty is we're talking about finances. So people may say, oh, religion and money, those are different things. But when we do things God's way, the statistics prove that over time, we do better financially when we're obeying God's principles. And that shouldn't surprise us because God knows what he's talking about. So you have a 92 to a 97% likelihood of avoiding poverty if you graduate high school, get married, and wait to have kids till after you're married. Those three simple things give you a 92 to a 97% likelihood to avoid being in poverty. Meanwhile, the government is over here siphoning money at trying to get rid of poverty ever since the 1960s, spending a bunch of money we don't have, and it's not working. When if we simply would do things God's way, things would come out a lot better than if the government said, well, we'll be God, we'll replace the father, we'll try to take care of families, and they do things their way instead of God's way, and the problems they are trying to solve actually get worse over time. Okay, so when married people don't do finances together, it's harder to win and to do well. And there's a term from people in the industry that's called financial infidelity. And the reason they've come up with the term financial infidelity is that when one of the spouses, when one of the spouses goes and spends money on something and keeps it a secret from their spouse, the feelings of hurt and betrayal that you experience are near on the same level of hurt and betrayal you would feel if they committed actual physical infidelity with somebody else. And I've heard the stories over and over. My wife went and racked up, not my wife, I'm just telling a hypothetical, okay? This isn't Melissa. Someone will say my wife went and racked up over a five-year period just spending sprees $40,000 in credit card debt, and she got too scared to tell me. And I'm furious because she kept it a secret, and I didn't know she was doing it. Wives will say my husband got an online gambling addiction and kept gambling and kept trying to win it back and didn't tell me he was spending the money, and now we're tens of thousands of dollars into debt. So it is in many ways a betrayal of the marriage and of the spouse if you go without their knowledge doing things you know that would make them uncomfortable and do something financially unwise. And there's something that's bothered me because it was on the tip of my tongue to say about gambling or about something else. That's what it was. One lady said, my husband took our savings, which I didn't know he took. It was an inheritance of like $500,000. And he decided that he would try to be a day trader on the stock market and try to guess how it was going to do and try to jump at individual stocks in and out and grow our $500,000. Does anybody know the stat, what they claim of day traders who try to guess what the market's going to do day by day, what percentage of them lose money? They claim it's 80%. So he was trying to do something that really was not very wise on paper to make money and get ahead, but he didn't tell his wife. So eventually he lost half of it, and then he panicked and wanted to get it back. And he kept putting in more and more and more till he had siphoned off their entire inheritance before the wife even knew about that. And that's just not right. So we could have different views of finances and of marriage. And someone may say, well, the Bible says the wife should submit to her husband. So let the husband do whatever he wants with the money and tell the wife, just don't worry about it. Well, not only is that... So there may be situations where you talk about it and pray about it, and there's a deadline and a decision you have to make, and it may be wise for the wife to submit to what her husband wants at that point. But it's not about submitting to the husband to say that it's practical wisdom and following biblical principles of marriage for couples to make major decisions together about their finances. This is only wise and prudent. This is loving and sacrificial care for each spouse to look at their husband or their wife and say, we need to do something with our money. We need to make a decision. Let's pray about it together and ask God to lead us to a decision that we both can be at peace at whenever possible. So a husband going and making a major financial decision without ever bringing it up to his wife and getting her input and praying about it together can be very hurtful and very unwise. What's one very practical way that married people can do finances together, and my personal opinion should do together, is join your bank accounts. Put a joint bank account where both of you have access to it. Both of you can always look and see what is happening to the money, and that you have a goal to keep nothing hidden from your spouse when it comes to the area of your finances, but it's all out in the open. If you get married and your spouse has debt, guess what? It's not just their debt anymore. It's your debt collectively because you married them. And in the eyes of God, you're one now. And it's wrong to look at them and say, well, your problems are your problems. And that is true whether it's finances, whether it's health problems, or whatever else the case may be. You wouldn't look at a sick spouse and say, oh, well, you got really sick. I guess you'll have to figure out how you're going to get to the doctor. That's too bad. I'm not sick. I'm good. So too, you wouldn't look at a spouse who's made bad decisions financially and say, that's your problem. You made a problem, you fix it. If you're doing it the biblical way, whatever problem exists in the marriage is both of your problem. And whatever blessings exist, it's both of your blessings. So a husband could say, well, I made $90,000 this year and you made $20,000. So I get to decide everything because I'm making all the money. But that would be wrong too. And that would not be taking the biblical approach of being heirs together of the grace of life. The other way you can do finances together is that both spouses should be educated financially. It's probably not a good idea that one spouse has no idea how to pay a bill or where the life insurance papers are or some basic things. And again, whatever your dynamic is, that's fine. In my house, I take care of most of those things. And if something happened to me, she might have to figure out some of the things that are on auto pay and where it's going. And maybe I haven't done the best job of showing her, but she's very capable of knowing what's going on because we talk about it and paying bills. And in a lot of families, the wife handles every single one of those details. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that if the wife takes care of paying the bills. But what I'm saying is, I don't know, I guess it would be a bad idea if the husband died and the wife didn't have a penny to her name, and she'd never had any idea about how to access the bank account, where's the life insurance papers, a plan for what she may need to do if there's not enough life insurance. And it's probably not a good idea if the wife dies and the husband doesn't know how to use a can opener, okay? So we both might have different things that we do and different strengths and ways that we approach it, and that's fine. But money is just one area where it's very important that the husband and the wife have a basic financial education, but also a basic knowledge of how the finances of the home are working. Another thing that's important is to have life insurance and a will. Especially if you have assets involved, if you have children involved, if the two of you were to die in a car accident, you probably wouldn't want a grandparent arguing with an uncle and another grandparent about where your kids are going to live. So when you do those things together as a married couple, it gives you peace and a vision of the future that if something goes wrong, there's life insurance taken out so that the other spouse won't be totally destitute while they're figuring it out. Another way we can do finances together is to make a budget and a plan and do that together. So the husband could say, well, you get $100 a week for groceries and that's it. Or the wife could say, I've decided you're not allowed to play golf anymore and that's it. Or you could sit down together and talk about it and make a plan where you both are equal partners valuing what each other has to say about it. And you're not dishonoring your spouse by trying to steamroll them and say you don't have any say in the finances for whatever reason that may be. If somebody has had a problem with, you could call it the financial infidelity or the inability to stop lying about finances or running up tons of debt on a credit card, then maybe you need to have some separation there in the finances And the person who says they're repenting needs to be accountable and probably step back from that money and agree that that's okay. But the basics of it is that you want to do it together. When you make a budget and a financial plan as a married couple, a good idea is to talk about the why you want to stick to your budget. Why do you want to accomplish your goals? What are your dreams? So a common scenario they say plays out is that the finances haven't been going well. And it can be either way, but the husband or the wife figures out that we're in really bad straits and we've run up a lot of debt. We need to get out of it. And they watch some YouTube videos and want a plan. And then they go real aggressively at their spouse and say, we've got to stop spending any money and you've got to stop going to that thing you like to do. And I'm telling you, we need to get out of debt and do better. Yes, it's a good idea to say we need to get out of debt together and do better, but each spouse plays a role in maybe how that situation went poorly in the first place, so they could go humbly and say, let's talk about what we need to fix, but also talk about why. What are dreams we want to accomplish? What will us getting control of our finances do for us when we're at retirement age? What about that trip we want to take if we clean up our credit card debt and actually can save up for it? And what if we could pay cash for that really nice trip we've been dreaming about taking, and we could do it without the stress of we're going to have to pay off the credit card later? So that's one way that you can do it together, is you make your plan together, but you also dream together. You talk about why you want to stick to your budget and accomplish your goals and whatever it may be. So in doing finances together, don't be selfish, but work together. Value what your spouse values. Make a deal sometimes. Okay, you want to buy that nice piece of equipment, you want to buy a gun, that doesn't make any sense to me, the wife can say. And the husband might say, well, you want to buy that really nice handbag, and that makes no sense to me. We'll say, you go ahead and go first, and we'll save up, and once we buy you the nice handbag, then after we save up next, I'll buy the nice gun. So I'm not saying that's how it works, is you do deals and trade, but that's not a bad idea in a way to do it together and to make sure that you're not steamrolling your spouse and not valuing what's important to them. Well, show me on paper how what she wants makes logical sense. Or you could say, if it's important to her, and we can buy a gun or a handbag or whatever it is, if we pay cash for it and we're giving to the Lord and we're not neglecting our other responsibilities and goals, there's nothing wrong with any of that. So I can show my spouse not that I understand what they want or that I value that specific item, but because I love them and value them, I want to see how can we both work together for long-term goals. Okay. So when we look to pay off debt, we're doing it with a better future in mind. Let's look here at Proverbs 31. I'm going to read all 20 of these verses here, and then we'll only have a half page of notes after that. But notice how Proverbs 31, when it's talking about the virtuous woman, very many of the things it has to say in this passage has to do with finances, and how the wife wisely managing finances at home is a blessing to her husband and to the home as a whole. So again, in our day and age, this may look very different. And a lady who never works but stays home with the kids should not be shamed. She should be praised for having the highest calling of all. And a lot of times in a family with several kids where the wife doesn't work, if you were to source out what she does for the family and see what it would cost to pay for that out of pocket, she's actually making near a full-time salary if you count that you otherwise would have had to pay for daycare and for meals and all whatever else the woman may be doing. So I don't think working outside of the home is wrong. I don't think wisely managing the household finances is to be undervalued. And what maybe she does something at home on the side when she can that makes a little bit of money. Whatever the actual details of it may look like, Proverbs 31 talks about a virtuous woman and gives several examples in this hypothetical proverb story about how she was being a blessing to her household financially. Who can find a virtuous woman, for her price is far above rubies? The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. The phrase there, have no need of spoil, literally means he won't have lack of gain or of material goods. He can trust in his wife that she will handle herself and help handle the money in a way where he's not going to end up in the poorhouse because she was not being wise in the way she handled things. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She is like, verse 13, she seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. Again, she's not lazy, but she uses her hands for wool and for flax and for knitting and making things for the family and that she can resell. She is like the merchant's ships. She bringeth her food from afar. This verse probably has to do with her wisely comparing the prices of things and seeing, well, if we can bring the food from a little bit farther away, that's going to help us save money and help us do better. She, verse 15, riseth also while it is yet night. There's no laziness there. She's willing to work. And giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hand, she planteth a vineyard. So she looks and sees a field that is for sale. She bargains with it. She buys it and she plants a vineyard on that vacant lot so that her family can eat some of the fruit that is grown there. Now, again, the point of these stories in Proverbs is not, well, every woman in here needs to go buy a field and plant on it. It's a general story. It's a general principle. But we do notice that the wife is very involved with what's going on with the household financially. And through her wisdom and prudence and ability to help manage things and buy a field and plant and grow things on it, she's being a blessing to her family. She girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good, what she has to sell, and her candle goes not out by night. She's willing to work hard. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff, which is another part of the spindle where she's making things. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh fine linen and selleth it and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. So again, the picture is she's going to the street market where the business is taking place, and the thing she made with her hands, she's trading it with the merchant so she can get paid, and he then resells it. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. So she's involved in what's going on. She's wisely managing the household, and she's not being idle or lazy. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. So all of that to say two simple things from the Bible. A man is primarily tasked with being the provider for his wife and children. Paul said, if any provide not for his own, he's worse than an unbeliever, and he has denied the faith. But Proverbs 31 and the other general principles about marriage show us that the wife too should not be shoved in a corner and devalued, and she shouldn't be unwise in how she manages the house, how she manages her time, but she should be involved in what's going on financially too, so that as heirs together of the grace of life, we move forward as a team and we seek to do better and to win. And I believe that God blesses when we honor our spouse in this way. I had something written in here somewhere that I am not seeing that is annoying me, and I want to see how I wrote it and I don't see it. But I know that statistically, they say over the long run, with every study they've done, married people are more likely to be happier, to live a long life, and to do better financially. So again, we're talking about finances as the main thing. But as we look at all that, it's almost like we could say God knows what he's doing, and God makes good things. And marriage is a good thing, and it's not always perfect, and it's not always easy. But if we apply ourselves and die to self and work together to see goals accomplished, to me, it's a little bit backwards. I mean, okay, the living longer, the being happier, married people tend to do. But in my first thought, I'd say, wouldn't single people tend to do better financially over the long haul? I think there's a couple of different reasons. One is the synergy effect, that when two horses go to pull a load, it's not one plus one. If one horse can haul 300 pounds and another one can haul 300 pounds, you put them together and they can haul more than 1,000. And whatever the numbers are, you can Google that and see the science that when two are working together, they do more than one person over here added to what one person over here does. I think another reason, perhaps financially, that married people do better in the long run is people who get married and stay married do better in the long run. I've met people in the past, I don't work with them anymore, but coworkers who are dating somebody while they've been through three or four divorces, while they're paying child support to every single person they divorced in the past. You don't do as well financially when that's what you're doing. You're paying child support, you're paying alimony, you're always moving on, and you're not getting traction that you would get even just in a practical financial sense if you got married, stayed married, and worked together. So it's a finance thing, but it's a general biblical thing. Work on your marriage. Be grateful you have someone to be married to. Do money together, and in the long run, those investments will pay off. Number eight, which is the last point in this particular outline, being a tightwad can actually hurt your family. So the definition of a tightwad is someone who doesn't want to spend money. The other word could be miserly. There might be plenty of money, but they're so obsessed with not spending money that anytime somebody talks about, let's go to McDonald's because we're really busy today. Well, you know, we could go home and eat a peanut butter sandwich and that would save us $5. A tightwad is somebody who looks and they may have the money there to spend, but they drive everybody crazy by clenching their fist, refusing to spend it, and always complaining whenever money is involved. Look at these verses from Proverbs. I'm almost concluded with this section here. There is that scattereth and yet increaseth. The idea there is there's somebody who takes what he has and is scattering it around, giving it away. Yet he's actually increasing and doing well as he's giving. And there is that withholdeth more than his meat, but it tendeth to poverty. So he withholds and says, no, I'll not give away in measure that it would be appropriate for me to give. But over time, that holding on and refusing to give anything, it actually tends to poverty. Jesus said, give and it shall be given unto you. But to the servant who had one talent and buried it in the ground, he was rebuked in that parable that Jesus told. Verse 25, the liberal, meaning the free giving soul, shall be made fat. And he that watereth shall be watered also himself. This is a natural result of following God's principles. We water, we give away what we have to see other things do well and grow. And God sees to it that we're watered back and that our needs are taken care of. He that withholdeth corn, the people shall curse him. The idea being a ruler who says, no, everybody do with less. Keep the corn supply. Don't let the people have it. And the people curse him because they're hungry. And he's holding on tightly to the resources that are available. But blessing shall be upon the head of him that selleth it, that makes it available to people. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 and 7. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly, meaning giving and planting in the ground, shall reap also sparingly. Let me see. I think I got my connection back here. All right. He which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall also reap bountifully. It's a simple principle of nature, but also with God applied to his people. If you give generously, then God sees to it that you get taken care of. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. In other words, God is generous. Let us be generous just like God has been with us. Matthew 10:8, Jesus gave a directive to his disciples as he was sending out the 12. He said, heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Then he added, freely ye have received, freely give. In other words, if we are recipients of the most lavish love of all, the love of God, the love of the Lord Jesus Christ, then who are we to hold on to what we have and refuse to give it to be a blessing to others? So we'll talk in a few weeks from now, probably a couple weeks from now, about generosity and what the Bible has to say about that. But what about this in a very practical sense when it comes to spending? You can love your family by not being paranoid about spending what you have, and by saying, if God's blessed us with it and we're not being unwise, then let's go ahead and use it and be blessed. Love your spouse. Do things that make them feel happy and fulfilled that they would like to do that require spending money on those things. Don't terrify your children by always talking about what things cost. And don't you know what it costs for me to put those Nike tennis shoes on you? So that's why you need to go be careful that you're not putting holes on them and scuffing them up. You can put anxiety in the mind of a child by obsessing over money and letting your stress about money be put upon them all the time. And even if times are tough, try to give freely and say, we're only going to do what we can, but this is for you to have. This is for you to enjoy. And not to be miserly and begrudge letting them have good things when it's available. So be wise, plan, and enjoy. If you're being wise, if you're not unwisely borrowing the money, if you're paying for it as you go, and you're giving, and you're paying your bills, and you're investing, and you're saving, and there's more to enjoy, then be intentional about it, but enjoy it. And know that God wants you to enjoy the good gifts that He gives to His children. Here's one more thing you can do when it comes to this is trust the numbers, not fear. The saying is facts don't care about your feelings. So one way to look at that is if it makes sense on paper that we can totally afford to do this and it's a good thing we would enjoy, but my feelings don't feel good about it and I feel scared about spending money even though the paper and the math and the budget says we can do it, then you're trusting your fear and your feelings over the factual evidence and data that says you can take your family on vacation and not complain about it the whole time. Melissa and I have this little thing where sometimes we go back and forth where, as I said, in a couple, not like a, in an arguing way, right? Because we don't, yeah, do that. But seriously, not in an arguing way, there'll be a sort of a major financial purchase or thing we want to do. And as I told you a few weeks ago, when I spend money, my natural bent based off of I don't know what is I feel sick. So I don't want to spend the money. And if we want to buy something, I want to look at the cheapest we can. And like I said, somebody like James has to help me say, Pastor, you probably should spend a little bit more on the church iPad so we're not crashing the live stream all the time. We have the money. It's okay. So sometimes we'll talk about it and I'll say, oh, I just don't know that number of spending it. And she'll say, well, we have the money. And I'll say, well, we have the money because I don't like to spend it in the first place. And if I had spent it, then we wouldn't have it now. So that's just a comical way. But this leads us into where I'm totally done with the study, other than for I want us to discuss a couple of things here. So page 3, I think, is what it will be in your handout, either page 3 or 4. If I can get mine to open here, it has a little graph where it talks about different personalities and how they feel about spending money. So I know the print is a little bit small, but it talks about a person who's naturally bent to save, what they fear and experience when it's time to spend money. The person who's naturally a spender, what they fear, and then the risk taker, the security seeker, and the flyer, meaning like the adventurous person who doesn't like commitment. So who would like to help read the top one there? What a saver fears. Anybody who can see that? Go ahead, Andrew, read it out loud.
My spouse will spend too much money. My spouse will pay full price on purchases. My spouse won't respect my savings. I will be viewed as cheap all the time. My spouse won't stick to the budget. We will go into debt.
So money is very emotional, and it brings about fears sometimes based off our different personalities. Who will read the spender fears?
I will.
Let's go, Anna, and then I'll have David read the one below that.
My spending will be under a microscope. I won't have the freedom to spend. I will be viewed as materialistic. I won't be able to give gifts when I want. I won't have enough money to spend.
And then, David, you can read the risk taker.
Marriage will limit
And then the security seeker, anybody want to read that one? I can go ahead and read it. I know the print is small, so I'll go ahead and read the last two unless somebody else says, no, I wanted to do that. Okay, I'll read it here. The security seeker fears we won't have a long-term plan. How will I take care of everything and everyone? I will be seen as a worrier. We won't have plans for retirement. And then the fears that a flyer might experience, would I think, it, like I said, is a person more adventurous by nature who doesn't like commitment. They fear, I'll have to get involved in the finances. My spouse will want to talk about money all the time. My spouse will care more about money than relationships and people's feelings, or I will have to follow a plan all the time. So we don't have to tell on ourselves or get too deep into the weeds, but I was curious, is anybody in the room that is married experienced differences in the way you're more naturally bent versus spender or saver? And is that something you've had to work out? Anybody? What about you two?
Well, I mean, there's been situations, but they're not. We come to agreements ultimately, but like you mentioned the iPad thing, right? Because I would initially be inclined to say, the cheaper one, or whatever. But she knows me well enough to know that I would look at all the specs. Be like, well, this one, you're gonna take these photos and you're gonna complain about the photos being crappy photos. So get the one with the better camera or whatever, right? Just get it now because, like, it's better to buy one good one than one crappy one. And then
you got to turn around and do something else. Without even details, is there anybody who's married that you and your spouse have a little bit of a different bent when it comes to spending, saving, money ideas? Anybody? One, couple. That's good. If not, that's okay. A few here and there. Like I said, I'm probably a little bit more likely to want to hold on and not do something. And she's more excited about, if we can do it, then let's go ahead and do it. So. That's great.
But the first couple of years, it was just like psychologically really important to me that I had my money.
Yeah.
I'm glad to know that over time that changed.
That's good, and that we can work on those things together. And I guess that's the other point I wanted to make is that sometimes you can try to understand where they're coming from more. So we may say, well, they're a tightwad. But it may be they have some things they've been through in their life where they saw a lot of hard times with their family. So to them, it's security, it's fear. And then the other person may think, well, they're reckless with money. But the other person thinks when you keep bringing up money all the time that you don't love them and you don't trust them. All of that type is things we have to work together for sometimes. So one more little slide here thing to talk about. But anybody else on that? All right. Just interesting things to think about. What are some tips that anybody might have for saving money that you've figured out for doing better in your budget? I heard a radio segment a while back where they were reading what people texted in as ways to save money. And one person said, stay at home and only eat whenever absolutely necessary. I thought that was good advice if you really wanted to save money. But one just very small thing for us we did for a little while when we were trying to save up some money before vacation is we shopped at Aldi. And Aldi has all the name brand, and you got to bring your own quarter. And I still thought it was pretty good, and I could definitely tell we saved a little bit of money by shopping there. And food in general is one of those things, if you're in desperate straits and you only shop for food you absolutely need to stay alive, you can free up a lot of money. We know going to a restaurant, you're paying a massive upcharge, so that could probably be more like for a treat rather than for something we do all the time because it's probably not great for us anyway. But I'm the worst about that in my life because I like to go out to eat. So anybody else, what's tips you found out before, ways for you to save money?
Well, just looking at your refrigerator and your freezer and you can see those months or even years of meat that is just still lying in there. I just did it this morning and I was able to cook something. because I was thinking of buying something, and before I know it, I told myself, let me check the freezer, and then, oh, there's something that I can probably cook that I don't need to buy. So now I'm just scavenging my freezer now.
I appreciate your patience here, and I really think in 5 minutes, depending on what y'all want to say, we can be done. But I saw a meme that said, in this house, we don't throw away leftovers. We put it in a Tupperware dish, shove it in the fridge, and then throw it away a week later. So when you pay attention to those types of things, it can actually help you save money. So the money's good. You're working 80 hours a week. You go out to eat. That's great. But if it's just something where we're like, well, I can't get out of debt. I can't accomplish this goal. Maybe we could if we were more disciplined in areas like that. Anybody else tips for saving money? Let's go Katie and then Emma after that. Yep, and also, yes, not forgetting about them. We talked about that. You'll end up paying for a lot of stuff you don't even know. I'm on, and then David.
So the lesson I would share is basically a quote I learned from a book called The Richest Man in Babylon, and it says, part of what you make is yours to keep. And what it really means is just take part of whatever money you're making and put it on the side before you even start calculating what you need to do. Because we have a tendency to fit into whatever amount we put for the month. Like if you put, if let's say you're spending on $3,000 today, and suddenly you get an increase to $5,000, you're going to find yourself in want. So even with the $2,000 extra. Just put money on the side before
the rest. I think the other way I've heard that is pay yourself first. Take some money and put it over here before I start paying everybody else to make sure I don't just squander it. And a good biblical principle, too, is the first fruits, where when we get paid, we take what we're going to give to the Lord, and we do that off the top. We say, this goes to God, this goes over here, and then we have more margin as we go forward. That's a good principle. David?
I was going to comment on the subscriptions thing. Oftentimes, so you don't forget, you can actually, when you get your 1 month free trial, you can immediately cancel it, but they'll keep it.
Yes, I've done that too. I know I want it for 30 days, so you get it, you click cancel, they say, are you sure? Okay, you'll be active till 30 days from now. Either that, or I go to my calendar on my phone and put alarms, or else I don't remember anything anymore. That's how I do it, so.
I was going to say, like, a lot of, like, with the groceries, the perishables are the ones that go. Like, salad mix. They make them in these big things, and you only ever want like a little bit, and you end up using like a third of it, and 2/3 of it just goes to waste. So like, either don't buy perishables, or maybe buy non-perishables or things that last, like canned goods, in bulk.
Yep.
Especially when they go on sale, and then for drinks, just drink water.
Drink water is better for you anyway, right?
And then.
And then multiple trips maybe for smaller perishable things help instead of trying to stock up and then you buy too much fresh stuff that gets thrown out. Deanne?
I don't know. Nothing against everybody here, but I just think the generation now is a little bit more wasteful than we used to be. I think we were a little bit more respectful of what we had. And I just really struggle with seeing the younger generation with kids and whatever going out to eat and pretty much ordering whatever the kid wants, whether it's more than they need or whatnot, and then they don't even take it home.
Ugh.
I hate that, because you can take it home, you can have it the next day for their lunch, you could do something with it, right? And I mean, that's just really hard for me to see that, because to me, that's just a waste.
It almost ruined my night one time. One of our favorite restaurants in my family for years and years, it's a place in McKinney off the highway called Shogun. And they do that hibachi thing where they cook it up right in front of you, the best fried rice. I mean, and these lady, this like mom and daughter ordered this giant plate, took like 8, 10%, 20% of the plate, and then they just left it. They said, no, we don't want it. Don't box it up. And I'm going, that is expensive, delicious food. So, you know, things like that, that maybe that doesn't kill our budget, but the principle of being in the habit of not being wasteful, in the long run, that's going to pay off and not waste things.
She'd always, because she was there, my family's a big dessert family, and she always had desserts and whatever, but she'd always order a happy birthday Jesus cake for Christmas. You know, we'd always have that as our tradition. And my nieces and nephews would just like, oh, Grandma, I want a big piece or whatever. And I would just know they're not even going to touch that piece. And I really like, I love cake and I love the ordered cakes. And I just think, and I am the one that loves the frosting. I know a lot of people scoop it off and put it to the side. I do not. And so I would just watch them take these pieces, and then they'd be running around playing, and their plates would sit there with these, this cake is expensive, sitting there with these big pieces with a, maybe a bite out. And I'd say to my mom, that was the only thing my mom would say, well, it's just dessert. And I said, no, Mom, I think the way you should do it is when you have little kids, is you should say, all right, I'm going to give you this size piece. If you eat this and you want more, I'll give you a little more. You know, do it that way, but don't let them have this humongous piece. One bite and that's it.
That's good wisdom.
That's right.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I was just recalling something. One thing, I'll make it real quick. But one thing I noticed with me and Anna is that, like, when we go out to eat, not like, you know, pick up food and take it back to the apartment. When we go out to eat, she very rarely finishes her food. And that's not a big deal. But what I've learned is that, like, if we split a meal and we're still hungry after it, we can order the second meal. But oftentimes we'll eat the meal and be perfectly fine. We don't ever order the second one anyway. So.
Then you get a longer date. You reorder, wait for them to bring it up. My problem is,
so we got room for dessert.
My problem has always been... My problem has always been I finish mine, and then if anybody else at the table doesn't finish theirs, I finish theirs too. So anyway, I have to work on that one. Okay, I know we're going a few minutes over, so let me just real quick, commercialism. We are just surrounded by the TV ads and the commercial radio ads and all of that, the social media ads, just with one word. How are those commercials designed to make us feel?
Hungry, pressure.
I was thinking dissatisfied, in want, covetous. It's designed to make you want things, and a lot of times it's things you don't really need. The Bible warns us against commercialism by saying, let's be content. So we said what we spend matters to a budget, but also what comes in. Has anybody ever had a side hustle that was really good for you with the amount of time you put in that made extra money with a part-time thing?
I did for a little while.
What was it?
I maintained aquariums.
Okay.
And it was $50 an hour.
Katie?
Didn't put much time into it.
I wanted an extra $1,200 at the end of the month one time, so I taught workshops on jewelry making and made myself $100 for 3 weeks.
There you go. When you get creative, there's all kinds of ways. Some people drive Uber or deliver pizzas for a few months, and you can make a goal. Saving money ideas. Sometimes if you're desperate, a family can go down to one car. And you just don't go places unless you all can go other than work. And, you know, you work around it until you accomplish a goal. Then hopefully you can get a car, another car in the future, because that's a lot easier for the wife. If we are faithful to give to God's work, will God bless us for doing that?
Yes.
What do y'all think? Yes, he will. Let's pray for God to enable us to be content. 808, I longer than I like to go anyway, but was there anybody else who wanted to quickly add something before we dismiss? Yes, and then Melissa. Katie, then Melissa.
It's a lot of fun. Don't rush it.
Yes. What's that? Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. I thought she was talking about money. I was like, husbands don't rush wives. Oh, she said don't rush church. Okay, I got it. Yes.
Just don't leave the house.
Exactly. That's what I said.
No, that's not a good statement. Amazon exists now. That's not a good statement.
Get a six-figure job.
She wants to stay home. That's right. That's where she'll go.
Delete your Amazon app. That's a good tip for saving money.
Go off the internet.
Like I said, I don't think I've ever heard a better one than don't leave your house and only eat whenever absolutely necessary when you're about to die. Then you'll save a lot of money. So.
If my husband told me I only had $100 to spend on food for a month, I'd give him ramen every night for a month.
There you go.
Then like, if you want something else, you can raise the budget.
Exactly.
Then
a delicious wife. That's some of the back and forth of how we work together on finances. Sometimes it takes a little bit of that. So.
Drink water and eat ice.
Yeah, that's what we said a couple weeks ago, too. You go do it then. Anybody else? I appreciate y'all being here. This has been a lot of fun this summer. I appreciate your attendance. Yes.
Right.
I've never been a coupon person, and that can be annoying, but they send the Advo to my house every week, and if you take about 30 seconds, you see who has the meat on sale. And that is a good way to say, well, this week Kroger has the ground beef for $3 a pound. This week it's 99 cents for pork. You could, your staples, you can save a lot of money by checking that or the rewards and all that. So. Yep. Exactly. Sometimes you got to put time into that as well. So, all right, for tonight, I think I'll just say thank you all for coming out, and God bless you. Hope you have a great week.